According to the British government's data in the year ending 2023, it is estimated that there are 2.4 million separated families and 3.8 million children in separated families. And 59% of the divided families had a child maintenance arrangement. These challenges can be even more complex in intercultural families, where cultural expectations and legal recognition may be different. Welcome to Debt Talk Podcast. With me, your host, Ripon Ray. This time, I'm going to speak about family planning, divorce, and debt. To assist me with this subject, in this month, I have Bilkis Khanum, who had been in a mixed relationship. Of course, she herself had experienced financial difficulties. And I have Matt Pellequin, a psychologist and founder of Support Fathers Right, an international organization that supports mental well-being and parental alienation. Finally, Ella Betts from Christian Against Poverty, which supports individuals in financial hardship. My panel members are also to provide top tips to Debt Talk listeners near the end of the podcast if any of the issues we speak about are going to resonate with them. So let me start the conversation with Bilkis Khanum, who lives in vibrant London, to share her experience of her life. So Bilkis, can you tell us how you and your white partner met?
So I first met my ex-partner. We used to work in Drug and Alcohol Project. I used to be prescribing methadone Subutex, and he used to make the reverse referral come through my doors. I'd do the assessment, and that's how we first met in a professional environment. He was always this loner, like no one would talk to him, and he was quite dark and mysterious, so to speak. But the world of drug and alcohol is really incestuous, like everyone knows everyone. So you go to one of the Home Office meeting, and everyone, oh, yeah, let's have a catch up, let's have a chin up. And we all work together in different settings and trainings and so forth. So yeah, that's how I think after our first workplace, we met in a second workplace and eventually met a third workplace. And that's when we started to spend more time together. And we had, I suppose, a bit of a background and knew each other from before. So we had a bit of history. And I suppose that's how we kind of met and decided to see where things took us.
So you kind of met in a local community centre or local group in East London, is that right?
Yeah, to be fair, it was actually in Entire Hamlets we were working together. And I remember my niece was saying, they call me Little Colour, meaning little auntie. They're like, you don't need a rescue project as a husband. And I was like, come on, let's be nice. Let's be, out there helping each other out. So, yeah.
From a Muslim background and choosing to plan a family with a white man, what was it like for you and your community, and most importantly, your immediate family?
So bearing in mind, I met Jason like 23 years ago. So it's a lot more different now than it was back then. Back then, it's a complete no-no. If you go down a path of marrying an English or anyone outside your community or your race, be prepared to be ostracized and disconnected from the community, from the family. That's the price you pay. So unfortunately, that's the price I had to pay. So my children were born into a family where they had no contact from the mum's side, like aunts, uncles, and so forth. But then again, I didn't have that support from Jason's side. His mum and his sister did, but no one else.
How did your family and your community kind of respond to that relationship? I know you were kind of a sideline, but what sort of thing did you hear? What sort of thing did you get?
Okay, what didn't make it any easier was when you look at Jason, he's quite a thuggy kind of looking guy because he's got tattoos from his chin all the way down to his toes. And amongst all that tattoos, he's got Adolf Hitler's initials on his elbow. So you can imagine how the community used to perceive him as like, I think there was a lot of trauma associated to people like that who are quite intimidating. And he himself studied psychotherapy, And even in the world of psychotherapy, people used to raise an eyebrow or two when they used to see all the tattoos that he had. So yeah, it was, and the family initially didn't welcome him, but I think it took about 8 years for them to embrace him.
So for you then, since we're talking about trauma and all those things, mentally, what strain have you had? What challenges mentally have you had?
Oh, geez. Like, I think a lack of support. Obviously, when women go through pregnancy, you've got the whole prenatal, postnatal, lack of support, isolated. Now, as from Bengali culture, I don't know if any other communities do this, but a pregnant woman is someone you run to. You feed them whatever they crave. And I remember craving Bengali fish curry, right? Don't get me wrong, I'm a coconut at the best of times, but I used to go to Brick Lane, Gram Bangla, and I used to sit there. And I remember I was having my labour pains, and I went there. I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. Just give me my paste and I'll be gone. Because I was told first pregnancy can take a couple of days. So I took my paste and I was licking it like an ice lolly, because that's what I was craving, fish curry or fish paste. So yeah, in that respect, I had no support, whereas normally it would be the sister-in-laws and the mother-in-laws and the mothers coming and bringing all these lovely types of food to help the baby grow. I didn't have that. I had Gram Bangla down Brick Lane doing that for me. So yeah. But eventually, I think it did impact on me having postnatal blues. And I felt it because obviously I didn't know what this was. And all of a sudden, I was just like, it was interesting because I didn't have, the only support I had with all my cousins that used to sneak over and see me after my son was born. So we kept our secret relationship. It was really quite funny. Like, growing up into our hamlet as a Bengali, we used to have double life, didn't we? We had a home life and we had a life outside of the front door. So it was, it did have a mental strain on me. And I think that impacted on me being what kind of a mum at a young age. Like, normally it's your mums and aunts that give you these little life tips and on how to be, like, to burp a baby, how to change a baby. And I think it's really funny. Growing up, they used to say, oh, this is the English girl, this is the Christian girl. And after I had my first child, I really delved into my culture so much. And even and my faith. And I just remember hearing this midwife say to a new mum who was bottle feeding, and I'm not being judgy, but it was really a profound moment for me. She said, look at you, you're feeding your child bottle because of vanity, when even animals feed their own children. And like, as a woman growing up in Tower Hamlets, I think back then I would say I was relatively poor because I had a full-time job, but on maternity leave, you don't get a lot of money. And in the Bengali culture, when you come, because Bengali families are huge, aren't they? So one sibling will buy a pushchair, one sibling will buy a cot, one sibling will buy the high chair, one sibling will buy a bouncer. I'd never had that. So I had to do everything myself. And because finance was limited, everything was eBay. So I got the car seat for £10. I bought the pushchair for like £200. You know, all these things, I had to think about debt management and be living within my means because we had other responsibilities. So yeah, that impacted on my mental strain.
So at what point did you realize that your relationship did not work, and how did it come to an end?
Oh my God. There was many red flags, and I should have nipped it in the bud back then. The multiple affairs probably should have been the red flag. But I think after I realised I was pregnant, I think it opened it up for me, like, I need to stick at this no matter what. And I remember my mum having this Bengali saying to me, you married into this house. The only way you're going to leave this house is in a coffin. So, which meant like you shut up, you deal with it as best you can, and you make a go of it. So, I think I was succumbed to the realization there's no way out. And that's quite a naive way of thinking about it in this day and age. And I didn't want to give up. I wanted to work out my relationship and my marriage for the sake of my faith and my children, really.
So, I mean, you didn't marry legally or through a civil marriage that is legally recognized. So what sort of issues did you come across since you weren't actually married legally?
Okay, so I was married Islamically in 2008, back garden jobby, and it cost me like £430. Woolies was closing down, and so I got a lot of things like 70% off at that season. But we did plan to have a registry ceremony in August 2023. And the thing is, my family wanted, obviously by this point, Jason had been included in the family, but there's so many things that have happened over the course of time. They didn't feel comfortable unless there was a prenup signed. And he fought tooth and nail. He didn't want to sign a prenup. And 3 weeks before the wedding, and this is an expensive wedding, and it was a big deal because I think what happened was there were 350 invites gone out. And one of the invitation, I met the King, King Charles, and me and him were having that. And I was like, oh, would you come to my wedding, please? He's like, how could I possibly do this? And I said, don't worry, Your Majesty, I've got this. I'm going to just tell everyone you're the King's lookalike. And he was chuckling away, and he just gave me the invite. So I gave it to his second in command. So it was a big deal. And 350 people wasn't a small wedding either. I suppose it's small in comparison to Bengali weddings. But Jason left like 3 weeks before the wedding in the middle of the night. And that was it. He wiped up the joint account, left me in £27,000 debt. And it's just been ongoing. And it's still ongoing, even down to, like, he's taken me to court. This time will be the eighth time he's taken me to court. And as you can imagine, court fees, legal team, representative, it's cost heaven and earth.
What was the legal issues about?
So he wanted, the last court case we attended was on the 4th of April. He asked the judge to remove me from my house, somewhere he hadn't lived in almost 2 years. He wanted me to move out and let him come and stay in the house with my children and me to continue paying the mortgage.
So in terms of paying, now, is he contributing towards child maintenance or anything else?
This man earns 80K a year, but he's figured out a loophole on how not to pay a penny to me. So every 6 weeks, he changes his job. So they have to do reassessment. Don't get me wrong, he has paid, but never the full amount. Like, let me give you an example. I've been hospitalized 3 times through sepsis and pneumonia. And on one occasion, I had sepsis shock. I was in hospital. The hospital rang the school. The school rang dad. The dad's response was, tell her to discharge herself and come and look after her own children. Bearing in mind, these are his children. So the school had to make a referral to children's services for abandonment. It gets better. 4 days later, I receive an email from Jason. And you can't make this up. Even when I read the email over again, it just cracks me up because you can't cry about it. In the email, he said he's charging me £70 for looking after one of my children for 14 hours. And this man's job is a children's social worker.
So looking back, Bilkis, do you feel safe now? I mean, how are you now emotionally and financially? And what helped you to reach this point?
I don't feel safe now. I've got a long way to go. I'm still like chopping away at this debt. I'm nowhere near, but I'm just done halfway gone. But unfortunately, I'm having to work night and day. Sometimes I work 70 hours a week. I do two jobs and I'm studying to be a nurse and I rarely see my children. That's the hardest thing for me, is not seeing them. And luckily for my son, but unfortunately for me, one of my children is on the spectrum. So he used to wind my son up and say all my friends are pedos or name calling. So now my son's 16 and he's gone and living with his dad. But what's happened is, you know, that parent alienation. So I think since my son went in March the 14th, I've seen him twice, because his dad, even in court on the 4th of April, he said to the judge, I forbid my son to go and see his mum. And it's interesting, the judge threw the case out on the 4th of April, just out of interest, because the grounds he was saying was all fabricated. He was saying that I was mentally unstable and I can't look after the children. And as a social worker, if you have a cause for concern for someone's mental health, you notify the GP, you notify the school, or you notify social services. This man didn't do that. He just notified the court for his own financial gain. So that's the reason why the judge realised what has happened. But even to get to that point, from my point of view, I had to pay a solicitor's £2,500 just to write a position statement for me. And this is what's costing me even more money, because every time I go to court, I'm having to spend between £2,500 and £7,000.
Thank you, Bilkis. Thank you for courageously sharing your story. Let me go and speak with Matt Pellequin from Support for Fathers' Rights, an international advocacy group designed to support dads in the justice system. By your sheer title, Matt, Support for Fathers' Rights, could you tell us the reason for developing such an initiative?
Like many people who get into the parental alienation space, professionally, it's from personal experience. And for me, it was living in a situation very similar to Bilkis. And in my case, being an extranjero, living in, being from the U.S., but living in Chile. And I had actually gone through things that most parents, especially fathers, don't really get the luxury of, and that is preparation, because I had gone through the threats of taking my son away from me. I had gone through that entire process for a good 2 years. Unfortunately, with my ex-wife being a diplomat, there was very little I can do due to diplomatic immunity and where we were living at the time. But when the marriage ended, it immediately followed the path of parental alienation, which starts with the false allegations. And as the legal system tends to work, as soon as there's a ruling in favor of the father, there's usually then a new false allegation. So that gets tied up in court. And then it's just rinse, wash and repeat. It just keeps happening over and over. So I realized that there were so many fathers who didn't have the luxury or the resources that I had. And especially in the case of being in Latin America, you realize that you're fighting against a system where fathers literally don't have any rights. And that is because traditionally fathers in the system haven't necessarily performed a lot of the tasks and duties that a parent should be doing. So it was always quite amazing to me when I would meet Chileans and they were, working a normal, like in Chile, like a 7 to 7 p.m. job. And then they would come home, eat dinner, and they would just go into a room and play video games. They weren't doing anything to raise their children. Whereas for me, as the trailing spouse, a diplomatic spouse, I was the one doing all the cooking, the cleaning, the shopping. And a lot of that was because these are things that needed to be done. And culturally, I had grown up doing these things. I didn't have a nanny doing them for me, as most people in the culture did. So you start hearing other stories and you realize that there's fathers that need help. And the reason for focusing on fathers is in no way connected to, any kind of misogamy, anything. It's simply just because, statistically speaking, fathers are more affected by parental alienation because it's there's more nuclear options that are used, which starts with domestic violence, so physical abuse. Then it becomes physical abuse against a child. And then lastly, it becomes sexual abuse against a child. Whereas with mothers, it's Bilka's story all the time. It's the quote unfit mother as the only rationale.
How do you see men's right represented during separation, especially when it comes to fatherhood? I know you covered a bit. Let's go deeper into it.
Yeah, it's really fascinating when you start factoring in cultures. And my background, my academic background is in psychology and communications, and I got into the business world getting an MBA, and I just returned about 4 years ago back into psychology and getting my doctorate. But I had a minor in sociology in university, and it was always something that I became a lifelong student of. Somebody who left my country in 2010 for good. I've been living all over the world in different cultures. And it's always amazing when you factor in some of these specifics when it comes to fatherhood. And, when we look at the stats overall across the world, they don't seem too unbalanced. But the reality is that if you were to remove the just one demographic, which would be Islamic nations, where the fathers have all the rights, it becomes very unbalanced. But it's always interesting when you start to look at what that role is when it comes to the other extranjeros, or people who are just from another country and living in that new country and dealing with that legal system, you realize that gender doesn't matter, and that the first role of the courts tends to be to prioritize the resident, the natural born citizen first, and it becomes this almost guilt until proven innocence type of a legal model.
In terms of, let's say, you specialize in mental well-being and psychological element of things that you've already mentioned, where are you seeing the major issues men face when dealing with the breakdown of a relationship?
Yeah, so it's that's the question that really summarizes why I went the path that I did in obtaining my doctorate. And that is that I decided that I wanted to help fathers that were going through the process of a divorce, of a separation, from the perspective of grief counseling. Very different. I'm not looking to make diagnosis. I'll make referrals if somebody needs another therapist, if I feel they need a little extra something, because statistically, when we get to the point of parental alienation, men are 11 times more likely to commit suicide than mothers of parental alienation. It's actually data from a study from Dr. Ben Hein, who is a renowned psychologist based in the UK in this space. But the reason for that is that when you are treating it from more of a grief perspective, and that you're grieving the life you thought you were going to have, you're grieving your role as a father that you thought you would be every morning getting up and making breakfast for your children, or taking them to school, picking them up from school, helping with their homework. And now that gets reduced in the best case scenario to 50% of the time. Now, that is basically saying, hey, you've been an Olympic athlete and you've been a distance runner, and we're going to cut off one of your legs now because you're losing half of it. And then when you're going in more with that perspective from grief, you're able to provide a little bit more when it comes to the finances and helping on that aspect so that you can help do your part to bring that rate down and get fathers to understand. And it's the same with mothers. It's just statistically in most communities by default, the mother's getting instant custody.
From your experience, what have the fathers been speaking about when it comes to separation and money is concerned?
It's always a factor because in some cases there's things like alimony involved where it's not just paying the child support, but it's also paying the mother of the children for instances where perhaps she gave up on her career to stay home and raise the kids. But culture and the specific society plays a role as well. So, for instance, in Chile, they make it very difficult for fathers to be able to afford child support when the person is a foreigner. And there's a reason why there's so many children who they go through, they're born from one parent who's local, another who's a foreigner. Foreigner, and the foreign parent ends up having to leave because they need to work to make more money because they're paying what is essentially an extranjero tax. So in my case personally, there's the added element of being an American. So I have to pay what one would call the gringo tax, which is that the child support that I pay per month in Chile is around $3,000 a month US, whereas the average in Chile is about $175 a month. And when you look at things like how do they come to that number? Well, normally it's based on, what the income is, but I'm legally was not even allowed to work in Chile. So on paper, my income was zero. And then they look at, say, the mother's income. Well, the way that the system works in Chile with diplomats is that you get paid basically 10x when you're abroad, and you go abroad for a maximum of 5 years, and then you have to go back to Chile, and then you're making the 1x. So if you are a diplomat who's just starting for the first time, you could be 21. When you're abroad, you're going to make $15,000 US per month. When you go back to Chile, you'll make 1,500. Well, the divorce happened in Chile, yet the salary that they use was based on her salary when she would be abroad. So that's how they get to those numbers. So many fathers go through situations like that. I know in cases where mothers are making more money than fathers, yes, it does happen as well. But when we're dealing with some of the more stunted cultures, when it comes to, machismo as well as classissimo and classist societies, it's always interesting.
Finally, Matt, what is it that you want to see more of when it comes to opening up dialogues in relationships and prioritizing children at the heart of it all?
I would say the most important factor there is creating new standards within the judicial systems all over the world. when it comes to family court, in that it's not a conspiracy theory to come across and say that the courts do not put children first. Because if they did, then it wouldn't take years or decades at times for people to kind of move through the system. And it is a system that is really designed towards bankrupting one person, and the winner ends up being the one with the most money versus what's actually best for the children, when all things are equal and there's no threat to the child.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you. Let me explore the financial issues that many families may experience when separation is concerned. Let me now speak with Ella Betts from Christian Against Poverty and bring her into conversation. So, Ella, what does your organization actually do, and in what way do you support individuals like Bilkis and Matt in that scenario?
Yeah, so we're a debt support service, and we exist to offer free independent debt advice to anybody experiencing debt. And we have a number of criteria that we have to check through in our initial call. But because of our face-to-face model within the community across the UK, we tend to work more with those on low incomes or who are vulnerable to financial crisis. And we've just released our latest client report actually last week, and that indicated that in 2024, 88% of our clients were single, and 9% of our clients in 2024 gave relationship breakdown as the primary reason for their debt, and 4% highlighted financial abuse as the primary reason for their debt. Now, I would emphasize the word primary here, because we know situations around debt, poverty, mental health, domestic abuse are incredibly complex and often interwoven. So the number of clients we have supported in the last year who have experienced domestic abuse is much higher than that. But what's quite interesting, 28% of our new clients in 2024 were single parents, which is significantly higher than in the wider UK population, where single parents make up 7% of the demographic. So I think this just really illustrates the pressures faced by single parents with rising living costs, and balancing household needs on a single income alongside repaying creditors where there's debt. So alongside the debt advice, we also offer job clubs, money coaching and life skills courses as well.
Briefly kind of touched on abuse, but speaking of domestic abuse, economic abuse is concerned, what is done with the money? What remedies are available to either parties?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to highlight what we mean when we talk about economic abuse in this context. And this is often categorized as three different forms. So we have economic sabotage, economic restriction, and economic exploitation. So when we're talking about economic sabotage, that involves things like actively hindering someone's ability to earn or maintain an income. And this might mean taking someone's wages, blocking access to benefits, or even forcing pregnancies to prevent employment and financial independence. Economic restriction is all about controlling someone's spending. It might look like giving a partner an allowance, enforcing a strict budget, demanding receipts for purchases, or limiting access to financial information. And then economic exploitation includes stealing money or property, causing damage to property that might incur costs, refusing to contribute to household expenses, misusing joint bank account funds, or coercing someone into debt by placing bills and loans solely in their name. Now, in 2021, there was a new Domestic Abuse Act released in the UK. And for the first time, this legally recognised and defined economic abuse as a form of domestic abuse. So this was a really positive progression in this arena in the UK. Within that, it acknowledged that most economic abuse falls under the existing controlling and coercive behaviour legislation of 2015. And within that, really encouraging victims to report to the police. This is a criminal activity. We really encourage our clients to report to the police where there's been criminal activity. But what's really vital to recognise, though, is that economic abuse very rarely occurs in isolation, often alongside other forms of abuse, highlighting the necessity for collaboration between debt advice services like ourselves at CAP and specialist domestic abuse support services for comprehensive risk assessments and safety planning for the client. Now, alongside this legislation, UK Finance developed guidance for financial services firms to help support victims. So the latest iteration was in April this year, and that really worked to help equip staff to identify signs of financial abuse. So maybe recognising when a customer has bank access controlled or there's a concern around coerced debt, and also advised the provision of safe spaces for disclosures. Now, essentially what that guidance does is put some of the onus back on the financial sector to identify and intervene, which is another really positive step forward in improving support for victims because it disrupts abusers and it continues to work to remove opportunities for economic abuse and exploitation within that sector. But just to come back to the question around practical remedies, there's a number of options here, but the main crux of it all is around severing the financial links and control of the abuser while securing the situation for the victim. So that's their safety around their finances, but also personal safety and the safety of any dependents as well. So some practical things that can be considered: some immediate safety considerations, such as issuing a new bank card and PIN numbers, using a different address rather than the one that they have on record. Similarly, sending statements and letters to different addresses or PO boxes where a client may be living in refuge accommodation. Removing any access the abuser may have to accounts, setting up code words so that no one else can speak on their behalf. In the case of joint accounts, banks can help to freeze accounts where there's concern of abuse or exploitation, and this stops any payments or withdrawals being made. Banks can support to open new accounts with minimal documentation if needed, particularly when somebody's working with a refuge or a social worker. The police can also help there. They can help to support to access information about what assets, debts, and payments are in the victim's name to gain visibility on the extent of the control. And you can we can also request corrections to a credit report.
Hey, so speaking of credit report and creditors, what could happen when you contact creditors without seeking free advice?
Yeah. So to get to a point where our debt advisors are actually able to provide a client with their debt solution options, it requires significant training in gathering and interpreting documentation. And that's often around priority and non-priority debts, as well as understanding the client's needs around living expenses, dependents, income, repayment potential, etc. So there's a risk that without that specialist knowledge and the bird's eye view, an individual might not actually get the best outcome. They may not receive the right advocacy and support, and that could result in unsustainable or unfair repayment terms. And again, in our recent client report, it showed that the average number of priority debts our clients came to us in 24 was four priority debts. And when it came to non-priority debts, it was 8 on average. And so having that many creditors on your back can be incredibly overwhelming. And when they're often all sending demanding letters and threats of enforcement. So there's a risk without that specialist knowledge, it could be a case of who's shouting loudest. And that's often not the most conducive way of addressing the overall debt situation. There's other support avenues available, like Breathing Space, which is a scheme that debt advisors can help individuals apply for. It's a 60-day grace period where creditors are unable to contact you. So it just gives you that time to look at what your options are, look at what the debt solutions are. So without a debt advisor or without an approved service, you wouldn't be able to apply for that. And then also just acknowledging and recognising that the area of challenging coerced debt or challenging liability is an incredibly traumatic process for somebody that's been in an abusive relationship. So having somebody on your side that can independently advise and advocate for you can be really, really helpful in that space.
And finally, Ella, in your experience, what are the biggest barriers that prevent people like Bilki's or Matt's clients from seeking advice timely?
Yeah, so a lot of our clients contact our new inquiries team absolutely drowning in shame and embarrassment. It feels like a huge taboo subject still in the UK. People are often overwhelmed in that space and the weight of debt, and they just may not have known where to turn to. When we consider victims of economic abuse on top of that, when we think about the fear, the threats of danger, it's a real significant factor in that space. So we know it takes approximately 50 incidents of domestic abuse for a victim to access effective support. And it takes on average 7 attempts for someone to leave an abusive relationship. So it can be really hard for a victim to speak out about their situation, particularly if we're considering other factors in this, such as children, financial dependency, or an uncertain immigration situation. And then also just to acknowledge, for a lot of our clients, their debt isn't always the priority issue amongst the plethora of other things going on in their lives. So when we're considering mental health needs, housing or homelessness, substance addiction, to name just a few, our clients are often juggling just so many precarious plates that debt isn't always going to be the first thing that needs addressing.
Thank you, Ella. Thank you so much. For those who are listening to Debt Talk, a podcast, and want to share your personal or professional experience, you can get in touch with me, ripon@debttalk.org. Now, let me now go back to my panel members, Bilkis, Matt, and Ella, so they can now provide us listeners top tips. Let me start with Bilkis, from your personal experience, Bilkis, what top tips would you like to give to Debt Talk listeners?
I think it's not to basically revolve your life around your children and your spouse. It's easier said than done. A lot of mums do this, like the whole world revolves around their children's timetable and their husband's timetable, and they lose their own identity. And I remember, after Jason left, it was quite a shock, because obviously we're getting married in 3 weeks' time. So I was thinking, oh, the man's going through a midlife crisis, because literally 8 months beforehand, he bought a Harley Davidson, he bought a Yamaha, and he bought a Triumph motorbikes, and he bought a boat. So I thought midlife crisis, but I didn't realise all the things that I couldn't do throughout my years with him. One of them was to go to university and finish my degree off. And then 2 weeks after he left, I enrolled to do my adult nursing course at London South Bank. So never forget yourself. Always have a contingency plan. Bengali women, I've learned from my older sisters, they have this secret bank account. And the fool that I am, never had this, because I wanted to be transparent and be supportive. No. So I think a spouse would be your spouse until something better comes along, or until something breaks down. But ultimately, always remember that you have to put yourself number one. And it's funny, because I was speaking to someone in America yesterday. She feels like her husband's having an affair. Da, da, da. I was like, right, now that you think this, start sorting yourself out, prepare for it. Because unless you're mentally prepared for it, you don't want the time to come when he's gone and you're thinking, where is everything? Like, the cards of your house of cards just shatter and fall. So plan your education, plan your finance, so when he does leave, you not fall into pieces.
Thank you, Bilkis. And now from Matt from Support Fathers Right.
I think it's important to supplement everything that you're doing with what can be done for free. And most of that is when it comes to the legal process. Now, if a person goes into the struggle of a separation and fighting for custody, it's a marathon. It's not something that is just, I'm going to hire a lawyer, we're going to have one trial, and it's going to be over. This is something that's going to happen for a while. And you need to plan accordingly. And think of it as looking like, you're planning dinner. Now, if you go and just say, okay, I don't know how to cook, I don't know what things cost, and you just were to show up at the supermarket and just buy things that look good without looking at the prices, it's a very different experience than if you're a chef at home and you know exactly the right ingredients. And sometimes you have to treat yourself. So yeah, you will get something that's a little bit more expensive, But that's maybe just that one ingredient. So the mindset is looking at and saying, if you can go down a path, in the US, for instance, there's a Facebook group called Pro Se Dads, and it's essentially a resource for fathers that are going through custody battles to be able to get tips from other people who have gone the route of self-representation. Now, I'm not saying that's the only path is self-representation, but if you have a conversation with your lawyer and you're actually bringing information to them about a specific country and precedent, it's showing the lawyer that you know what you're getting yourself into. And these are resources that are free, that you don't need to be taking a course for. It's just go out there and learn as much as you can and protect yourself, knowing that you have to find ways to be able to pay for the more expensive aspects of having a legal defense.
Thank you, Matt. And finally, Ella Betts from Christian Against Poverty.
Yes, I'd say to any listeners who are struggling with debt, please reach out. We have centres right across the country and we'd love to see if we can help you. You can give our new inquiries team a call Monday to Friday and they'll talk you through our referral process. And then just for any advisors or people working in financial services, I would just really encourage you to read up on economic abuse, learn about the signs to be aware of, and what support you could offer somebody within your role. Maybe spend some time with your local domestic abuse service, getting to know the support they offer. They're the specialists in that space. There's also another fantastic organisation called Surviving Economic Abuse, and they're brilliant. They've got loads of resources on their website, and they run courses, and they just can really help to upskill you in this area. But what I would say above all is just remember that this is a really complex situation, and working in partnership with the experts will get better outcomes for clients.
I'm very grateful to you, Bill Case, Matt, and Ella, for giving me your precious time. Without your input, believe me, Debt Talk won't be where it is right now. It has been rated the highest on this precise subject, debt-related subject in the UK. So, yeah, thank you very much. My next podcast is going to be on crypto, digital assets, and gambling. Thank you for listening to Debt Talk podcast with me, your host, Ripon Ray.